Griping not tolerated. That was the sign on the wall of the dormitory room welcoming me to Bob Jones College. Dr. Bob Jones Sr., the school's founder who had won our hearts when he spoke at Sharon High School back home, believed in authority, his, and discipline, ours, with capital letters. A military academy could not have been more strict. My father and mother had never been exactly lax in enforcing their rules on us children, as I could vouch for personally. But now I found myself in an environment so rigidly regimented that it shocked me. Dating had to be scheduled and governed by the dean's codebook. Outside of approved dating times, you could not stop to talk to your girlfriend. On certain evenings, though, you were allowed to sit in the lobby and talk, but only for 15 minutes, and you could always write notes. Even our intellectual life was subject to regulation. Teaching in every subject was dogmatic, and there was little chance to raise questions. Dr. Bob's interpretation of doctrine, ethics, and academics was the only one allowed. Very few students ever questioned his authority to his face, but sometimes, stretched out on the double-decker bunks in our tiny four-bedded rooms with the grim motto confronting us, we did discuss it, although always with fear in our voices. To make matters worse, we also loved Dr. Bob, as he was often called by us. Sometimes, as intimidating as a bull, he could also be as tender as a child. We could not help but sense that he had our best interests at heart in all the policies he imposed. His religious convictions and genuine devotion to the Lord kindled a deep respect in my heart. I have made all the mistakes in evangelism, he often said. There are no more to be made. That was memorable, but he never elaborated on what they were. As I look forward to a few days of Christmas vacation, I tried to sort things out in my mind. I disliked the overwhelming discipline, and I disliked being told what to think without having the opportunity to think it through on my own or to look at other viewpoints. I surely knew I was not fitting in where I was. I asked for an interview with Dr. Bob in his office and told him my thoughts of leaving. His voice booming, he pronounced me a failure and predicted more failure ahead. I left his office disillusioned and dejected. The family's Christmas plans all along had been to take Catherine, Melvin, little Jean, and me on a trip to Florida, where Mother's older sister, Sissy, had bought a large rooming house in the heart of Orlando. They hoped I could still get enough time off from school to make the trip. Still confused in my thinking, I headed south with them. By then, my parents had heard about Florida Bible Institute. Once in Florida, I immediately acquired a taste for the warmer climate and the palm trees. Raising oranges and cattle appealed to a lifelong farm boy like myself, and Orlando's many lakes attracted me too. I made up my mind to leave Bob Jones College in January. We arrived at the campus of Florida Bible Institute one morning late in January. It was located in Temple Terrace, 15 miles east of Tampa. The institute itself was housed in a Spanish-style country club hotel with several outbuildings and surrounded by a horseshoe-shaped 18-hole golf course. The buildings were part of an exclusive residential subdivision that went broke in 1929. A former Christian and Missionary Alliance minister from North Carolina, Dr. W.T. Watson, had taken over the bankrupt property and started the Florida Bible Institute as a non-denominational institution. 40 women and 30 men lived and ate and had our classes in the hotel complex. There was still plenty of room left over for paying customers, especially for ministers and Christian lay people, well-to-do Yankees as I saw them, who took advantage of the institute's comfortable quarters and reasonable rates in winter months. It cost a lot less than hotels and was far superior to tourist camps and trailer parks. Perhaps as many as 50 people from the north would spend the entire winter there. Others came and went. Every room had twin beds and a private bath, and some included sitting areas. Suites, really. We students were the workforce that ran the place. waiting on tables, cooking, washing dishes in the kitchen, doing the housekeeping, and handling the grounds maintenance, all for 20 cents an hour. But those were good wages because Dr. Watson, who had come from a poor home, managed to keep school fees down to $1 a day, all-inclusive. My father was paying my expenses and providing my pocket money, so I was affluent compared to some of the other students. I worked like everybody else, though, mainly to be part of the action and to spend some of my surplus nervous energy. I became the school's first automatic dishwasher, or so they told me. My pace and the soap suds races kept 4 girls busy with their dish towels. Preachers got reduced prices in exchange for speaking in our chapel and classes, or at Dr. Watson's independent church in St. Petersburg, the Gospel Tabernacle. That church had started in a ragged tent in the early 20s, but it now occupied a building seating 4,000 people. Many of those visiting preachers made a lasting impression on me in their own individual way. World-renowned evangelist Gypsy Smith, probably in his 70s by then, came and stayed for weeks at a time. I asked him for his autograph, but he turned me down. I felt hurt by the rebuff. Later, when we became good friends, I did get his autograph, and I promised myself that if anyone was ever kind enough to ask me for my autograph, I would gladly give it, if I possibly could. William Evans, former director of the Bible Department at Moody Bible Institute, particularly impressed my schoolmate Roy Gustafson, who would years later become a member of our evangelistic team. For carrying his golf clubs around the course, Dr. Evans tipped me $1 and told me to apply myself to my studies so that someday I would be in a position to give a tip too. My previous Fuller Brush salesmanship won me a place on the yearbook staff, drumming up advertising from local businesses. Wendell, my former roommate, and Woodrow Flynn, my present roommate, who had also attended Bob Jones College for a time, quickly introduced me all around to my new classmates, and I soon had a sense of belonging to a wonderful new family. I knew I was where I ought to be. The curriculum was largely Bible courses or subjects related to the Bible, for example, church history. It also offered me the saturation I wanted in the study of God's Word. I came to believe with all my heart in the full inspiration of the Bible. One thing that thrilled me was the diversity of viewpoints we were exposed to in the classroom, a wondrous blend of ecumenical and evangelical thought that was really ahead of its time. Our teachers came from different backgrounds and denominations, exhibiting to us what harmony could be present where Christ and His Word were loved and served. In their teaching, they were not afraid to let us know about other philosophies, and even about views critical of Christianity. Dr. Watson had actually dropped the word fundamentalist from the name of the school after its first 2 years, because it had come to connote such a negative image in the public mind. We were encouraged to think things through for ourselves, but always with the unique authority of Scripture as our guide. So many of the questions that I had had to keep bottled up previously could be freely aired and wisely answered. I could stretch my mind without feeling that I was doing violence to my soul. The faculty's openness and the diversity of visiting lecturers instilled in me a fresh enthusiasm for the Lord and a burst of energy to get involved in His work. I still had no clear plan of action for my life, however. I was as carefree and happy-go-lucky as ever, maybe more so, in this subtropical playground of the Lord's. The Institute was committed to equipping all of us for Christian witness in the world, even if not as preachers. So students were sent out regularly, both as individuals and in teams, to churches, missions, trailer parks, jails, street corners, and just about any other place that would have them. What we lacked in finesse, we made up in youthful exuberance. In the course of student assignments that came my way, I spoke almost regularly at the well-populated trailer parks in the winter months and at the stockade, Tampa's jail. The dean of men was the Reverend John Minder, a red-haired giant. The fact that Minder was a bachelor freed him to give a lot of time to each student as well as to his pastoral duties at the Tampa Gospel Tabernacle which he had founded. He saw me for what I was, a spindly farm boy with lots of nail-biting energy, a mediocre academic record, and a zeal to serve the Lord that exceeded my knowledge and skills. I enthusiastically took his courses in pastoral theology and hermeneutics, or Bible interpretation, and I responded instinctively and positively to his gentle counseling approach, so different from the authoritarian ways I had just experienced in Tennessee. Instead of resenting his advice, I wanted to hear everything he could tell me about life and service. He did not dictate how to think and what to do. Rather, he opened my thinking to consider the perfect trustworthiness of God and to rest in that. In early spring of 1937, at Easter, Dr. Minder invited me to accompany him on the 150-mile ride to his summer conference grounds at Lake Swan in northern Florida, a 150-acre property owned by his family. While there, on that cold, blustery Saturday, we got together in nearby Palatka with his friend Cecil Underwood, a lay preacher who was pastoring Peniel Baptist Church, 5 miles to the west. Out of the blue, Mr. Underwood asked Dean Minder if he would mind preaching for him the following evening at a small Baptist church in Boswick, for which Mr. Underwood had taken responsibility. "No," he answered. "Billy is going to preach." I was stunned. I told Mr. Underwood that I had never preached a formal sermon in front of a church audience. They both laughed. "We will pray for you," said Mr. Underwood, "and God will help you." The meeting room was small, with a pot-bellied iron stove near the front to take the chill off that cold, windy night. The song leader, who chewed tobacco, had to go to the door every so often to spit outside. He could have used the stove just as conveniently. The congregation of about 40 included ranchers and cowboys in overalls, and their women in cotton wash dresses. When the moment came to walk to the pulpit in the tiny Bostwick Baptist Church, my knees shook. I launched into sermon number one. It seemed to be almost over as soon as I got started. So I added number two, and number three, and eventually number four. Then I sat down. 8 minutes, that was all it took to preach all four of my sermons. Believe it or not, though, when I got back to campus, I had grown spiritually. But at the same time, I couldn't get away from a nagging in my heart that I was being called by God to preach the gospel. I didn't welcome that call. Whatever glimmer of talent Dr. Minder might have thought he saw in me was certainly raw, with a capital R. I practiced for when the time would again come to preach in public. I would paddle a canoe across the Hillsborough to a little island where I could address all creatures, great and small, from alligators to birds. Once, some fishermen, wandering within earshot, paused in amazement at this bellowing beanpole of a boy who seemed to rise from the river. Too often, a few of my fellow students would line the opposite bank at my return to cheer me on with comments such as, "How many converts did you get today, Billy?" In the 18 months since arriving at Florida Bible Institute, I had exercised some gifts and begun to develop some skills that I didn't know I had. I knew that I loved to tell people the good news of God's salvation in Jesus Christ. On Sundays, I often preached on the streets of Tampa, sometimes as many as 5 or 6 times a day. But in those days, the greatest ministry that God opened up to me was the trailer parks. One of them, the largest or close to it in the country, was known as Tin Can Trailer Park. The crowds ran anywhere from 200 to 1,000. They would take up a collection and give me $5, a tremendous help to my meager budget. Many people responded to my preaching by confessing faith in Christ and being converted. My teachers and classmates seemed to affirm that this ministry was good and right for me. But did I want to preach for a lifetime? I asked myself that question for the umpteenth time on one of my nighttime walks around the golf course. The inner irresistible urge would not subside. Finally, one night, I got down on my knees at the edge of the green. Then I prostrated myself down on the dewy turf. "Oh, God," I sobbed, "if you want me to serve you, I will." The moonlight, the moss, the breeze, the green, the golf course, all stayed the same. No sign in the heavens, no voice from above. But in my spirit, I knew I had been called to the ministry, and I knew my answer was yes. From that night in 1938 on, my purpose and objectives in life were set. I knew that I would be a preacher of the gospel. I did not know how or when, however. Then came the big break I had been longing for. Dr. Minder's old friend, Cecil Underwood, arranged for me to preach for a week at the East Palatka Baptist Church. And not only in the church, but also live over radio station WFOY in nearby St. Augustine every morning. By now, I had prepared and practiced about 15 sermons, full-length ones, and I was ready to go. Every night, a congregation of 150 filled the church building. I became irritated at some of the young people who always sat in the back pews and cut up during the services. I scolded them from the pulpit and even threatened to go back there and throw them out bodily. At that, the son of a leading member of the church jumped up, shook his fist at me, and stalked out, slamming the screen door behind him. I let the people know I could do other things beside preach, threatening that if there was a repeat performance of that behavior, I would give the boy a whipping. I think he came back two nights later. Fortunately, I wasn't challenged to make good on my threat. Despite my immaturity, the Lord graciously moved 80 people to profess conversion that week, and many of them joined the church. I could not doubt that His hand was on me, which made me practice my sermons all the harder every day. I was so keyed up that I could hardly sleep at night, and yet I also had to drive on a rural road the 28 miles from Palatka to St. Augustine and back in the morning in order to preach on the radio. A byproduct of my Palatka experience was my third baptism. In accordance with their Presbyterian covenant theology, my parents had presented their infant son for baptism by sprinkling in 1919 at Chalmers Memorial Church back home. I had never questioned the validity of that solemn act of commitment on their part, born of a heart desire to have their child identified with a household of faith. Years later, as a youngster, after studying the catechism, I was confirmed in the faith by declaring my personal allegiance to the Lord. In Florida, I had become convinced that I should be baptized by immersion, and had arranged quietly for Dr. Minder to do that. It was an adult act, following my conscious conversion, and signified my dying to sin and rising again to a new life in Christ, as Paul described it in Romans 6. But preaching in Southern Baptist churches raised a problem for me. Cecil Underwood pointed out that for Southern Baptists to invite preachers from other denominations, especially Presbyterians, into their pulpits was like defying a sacred tradition. Although he did not care one way or the other, not being a strict denominationalist himself, he thought that if I did not want to have a row with the deacons, I would be wise to be immersed under Southern Baptist auspices. In late 1938, therefore, Cecil Underwood immersed me in Silver Lake, with people from the church on the shore to witness the ordinance. I waded down into the water, where he lowered me under and lifted me out in less than 3 seconds. I waded ashore again and went into a little shanty bathhouse to change into dry clothes. Early in 1939, Woodrow Flynn came to me and said, "I think you ought to be ordained. That would give you a standing in the Baptist Association and be of great benefit to you in many ways." Woodrow and I talked it over and prayed about it. We agreed to get in touch with Cecil Underwood, who was still pastor at Penile Baptist Church near Palatka. Cecil was glad to call together 4 or 5 neighboring pastors to form an ordination council. On a Sunday in February, after I preached at one of the churches, we went to Penile for the 2 o'clock session. The handful of rural Southern Baptist pastors took their responsibility seriously, and under Cecil's considerate direction, commenced to question me in a kindly way about my background and beliefs. I knelt on the little platform in front of a small congregation and was encircled by a half dozen country preachers. I felt the light touch of their outstretched fingers and calloused hands on my blonde head and bony shoulders as they prayed me into their distinguished fellowship. When I stood up again, I was an ordained Southern Baptist minister in the St. John's River Association. Being ordained meant lots of things. Now I had sanction to perform weddings, conduct funerals, and officiate in church activities not open to me before. Far more important, though, by that simple act of ordination, I was henceforth set apart for the preaching of the gospel. Ordination didn't elevate me to superiority over my fellow Christians who sat in the pews and listened, even if I stood in a high pulpit. On the contrary, it specially designated me to be their servant, their shepherd, for Christ's sake. It was meant to nurture in me humility, not pride. In May 1940, I was graduated from Florida Bible Institute. The certainty about a call to preach motivated me to desire further education. An accredited college of liberal arts seemed to be the next step. I had a particular one in mind because of two visitors from Chicago who came to stay at Temple Terrace in the winter of my senior year. A Chicago attorney, Paul Fisher, stayed in the Institute's hotel section with a businessman friend, Elner Edmond, and Mr. Edmond's mother. Fisher's brother, Herman, was chairman of the board at Wheaton College, just west of Chicago. Edmond's brother, Ray, was a history professor and interim president of the school. After hearing me preach, they talked to me about getting further training at Wheaton College. Paul Fisher astonished me when he offered to pay my tuition at Wheaton for the first year, and Elner Edmond volunteered to help with other expenses. As to being admitted, I could hardly have had more influential references. Things began to look hopeful. With some misgivings and anxiety, I applied for admission and was accepted. Thus it was that I drove to Wheaton in September 1940 and began college. Most of my Florida Bible Institute credits were not accepted. The few credits that were accepted gave me second semester freshman rank. Though it did not call itself fundamentalist, this venerable institution demanded rigid adherence to a code of conduct that prohibited staff as well as students from using tobacco or alcohol in any form, dancing, card-playing, or joining secret societies. On the elm-shaded suburban campus 25 miles due west of Chicago's downtown loop, I felt like a hick. In the first 6 weeks, missing the old friends in sunny Florida and the recent exhilaration of preaching, I was so miserable that I began to wonder if I had made a mistake. As for my initial homesickness, the Lane family soon came to my rescue. Dr. Mortimer B. Lane taught courses in government and economics at the college. Before that, when he was in government service, he and his wife and their 7 children had lived in Switzerland. Quite well off, they entertained students in their large, comfortable Victorian home near the campus. They welcomed me as one of their own. Early on Sunday mornings, as Plymouth Brethren, they hosted a small local assembly in their house. I began to attend that quiet communion service with students from other churches. Downtown, a church known as the Tab met on Sundays in the Masonic Lodge. The congregation was filling in with student supply preachers, and I was invited to speak one Sunday. The $15 honorarium they gave me was generous and much appreciated. Repeat invitations to the Tab followed. In their Sunday crowd of 300, packing that hall to capacity, were business and professional people, college students, and most intimidating of all, professors. In the summer of 1941, they called me to be their regular pastor when I returned to the college in the fall. After my first year at Wheaton, I returned to Charlotte, where I was honored by the home folks with an invitation to preach for a week of meetings at Sharon Presbyterian Church. I was nervous at first. It surely was another case where dependence on the Lord was my only hope. And it was another case where he proved himself faithful beyond imagination. Good crowds turned out for the services. They listened respectfully, and a number of people made commitments to Christ that week. When I returned to Wheaton for the fall semester, I tackled my pastorate at the tab with enthusiasm. I had to prepare and preach two sermons every week and lead a prayer meeting on Wednesday nights. What I lacked in content, I made up in volume. My responsibilities at the tab, however, did turn out to be detrimental to my studies. To do more preaching, I had to do less studying, and the dilemma really developed there. I missed a great deal in the classroom. On Sunday evening, December 7, 1941, someone told me that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. I had never heard of it. On the way from the tab back to my room, I heard from a newsboy hawking a special edition of the Chicago Tribune that the United States was at war with Japan. My first thought was to volunteer. Not that I felt I would make a good fighting man. As a cadet in the Army training program on campus, I had nearly cut one fellow's head off with my bayonet when I made a sudden and a wrong turn during a drill. But as an ordained Baptist minister, I knew there had to be a place in the chaplain's corps for a person like me. I wrote immediately to the War Department to ask about the possibility of becoming a chaplain. They said I would have to finish college and then take a seminary course. In the next three semesters, schoolwork took on a new seriousness, and the pastoral ministry to members of the TAB congregation deepened along with the preaching. Life and death were not abstractions to us anymore, and the Wheaton Township of 7,000 shared with the rest of the nation the anxiety and pain and grief of war. Wheaton was both a spiritual and intellectual turning point in my life. It also became a turning point in another significant way. Saturday nights I dedicate to prayer and study in preparation for the Lord's Day. What kind of a romance could a college man have with a woman who said a thing like that? Dating Ruth Bell had to be creative. For example, on one occasion we took a long walk in the countryside surrounding Wheaton to a graveyard where we read tombstone epitaphs. Ruth, born in China, had spent her first 17 years in Asia. Her father, Dr. L. Nelson Bell, was a medical missionary in the eastern Chinese province of northern Jiangsu, and her family lived in the hospital compound. Theirs was a hard existence, and certainly not a sheltered one. In more ways than one, she was one of the Bells of Wheaton campus. It took me a month to muster the courage to ask her out for a date. One day in the library in Blanchard Hall, I saw Ruth studying at one of the long tables. I sauntered nonchalantly across to Ruth and scribbled my proposal for a date to a concert. To my surprise and delight, she agreed to go. That Sunday afternoon was cold and snowy. With Ruth Bell sitting beside me in Pierce Chapel, I did not pay much attention to the music. Afterward, we walked over to the Lane house for a cup of tea, and we had a chance to talk. I just could not believe that anyone could be so spiritual and so beautiful at one and the same time. Ruth went back to her room, she told me later, got on her knees, and told the Lord that if she could spend the rest of her life serving Him with me, she would consider it the greatest privilege imaginable. So why did she make it so hard for me to get her to say yes out loud? If I had not been smitten with love at the first sight of Ruth Bell, I would certainly have been the exception. Many of the men at Wheaton thought she was stunning, petite, vivacious, smart, talented, witty, stylish, amiable, and unattached. What more could a fellow ask for? Add to that the fact that her Virginia-based parents and their missionary companions were all in China under the auspices of the Southern Presbyterian denomination. Not the Associated Reformed Presbyterian Church I had grown up in, but close enough. And there was one minor problem that kept coming up. She wanted me to go with her as a missionary to Tibet. My mind was not closed to such a possibility, not completely. After all, I had chosen to major in anthropology with just such a contingency in mind. But missionary work was a lot more comfortable to consider in the global abstract than in the Tibetan concrete. In that list of good adjectives I just assigned to Ruth, I omitted one, determined. She felt that God had called her to be a missionary to the remote borders of Tibet, just as strongly as I felt He had called me to preach the gospel. In my case, though, there was not a geographical stipulation. Two things I felt sure of. First, that Ruth was bound to get married someday. And second, that I was the man she would marry. Beyond that, I did not try to pressure her or persuade her, that is to say, not overly much. I let God do my courting for me. But as the months went by, I asked her to at least consider me. It would not have been right to let her assume that what seemed to be my heroic understanding of her concerns was a lack of interest or expectation on my part. We had lots of discussions about our relationship. I wouldn't call them arguments exactly, but we certainly didn't see eye to eye. By now, I had directly proposed marriage to Ruth, and she was struggling with her decision. At the same time, she encouraged me to keep an open mind about the alternative of my going to the mission field. She was coming to realize, though, that the Lord was not calling me in that direction. She did not say yes to my proposal right then and there, but I knew she was thinking it over. A test of our bond came when her sister Rosa was diagnosed as having tuberculosis. Ruth dropped out of school in the middle of my second semester to care for her. Rosa was placed in a hospital in New Mexico, and Ruth stayed with her the next fall, too. That summer, I returned home and preached in several churches in the South. Ruth's parents had returned from China on a furlough. Actually, the Japanese had invaded the mainland, so the Bells weren't sure if they could ever return, and had settled temporarily in Virginia, which happened to be their home state. While I was in Florida preaching in Dr. Minder's church, I got a thick letter from Ruth postmarked July 6, 1941. One of the first sentences made me ecstatic, and I took off running. "I will marry you," she wrote. When I went back to my room, I read that letter over and over until church time. On page after page, Ruth explained how the Lord had worked in her heart and said she felt He wanted her to marry me. That night, I got up to the pulpit and preached. When I finished and sat down, the pastor turned to me. "Do you know what you just said?" he asked. "No," I confessed. "I'm not sure the people did either." At the close of a preaching series just after that at Sharon Presbyterian Church in Charlotte, those dear people gave me, as I recall, an offering of $165. I raced right out and spent almost all of it on an engagement ring with a diamond so big you could almost see it with a magnifying glass. Ruth was staying part of that summer in a cottage not far. I drove there and took Ruth up to what is now the Blue Ridge Parkway. The sun was sinking on one side of us and the moon rising on the other. I kissed Ruth on the lips for the first time. I thought it was romantic, but she thought, or so she told me later, that I was going to swallow her. "I cannot wear the ring until I get permission from my parents," she said apologetically. They were away, so she sent them a telegram. "Bill has offered me a ring. May I wear it?" "Yes," they wired back, "if it fits." Later in that summer of 1941, Ruth decided to visit her parents. She took a train to Waynesboro, Virginia, where I was to join her. I had to go, of course, to meet them, to pass inspection. I drove my Plymouth from Charlotte through North Carolina, stopping on the way to give a brief message on a Christian radio station. About 5 miles out of Waynesboro, I stopped and changed into a suit and tie. When I finally pulled up, Ruth rushed out to greet me. I froze. Ruth was the woman of my dreams, but the delightful in-laws I would gain in the process would make our eventual marriage all the better. Our relationship deepened in the next year. I was studying, working, and preaching at the Tab. I began to listen to Tory Johnson's Midwest Bible Hour on Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock, and to Songs in the Night, a 45-minute program on WCFL, Chicago's most powerful radio station, on Sunday nights. Rosa got better, and Ruth returned to Wheaton. In addition to her shopping and finishing up her senior year at college, with an earnest plea to her parents to pray that she would pass the comprehensive exams in the spring, she joined me on Sunday mornings, first at the Lanes home for a Plymouth Brethren meeting, then later at the Tab, where I preached. But I, too, had schoolwork to finish, and I think she was exasperated by the fact that I was on the road so often. Already she sensed what kind of a future we faced together. Something loomed immediately ahead, though, that made Ruth and me both expect me to stay put a little more. One day a big Lincoln Continental pulled up in front of the house where I was rooming, and a young man bounded up the steps and asked to see me. He turned out to be president of Hitchcock Publishing Company in Chicago and treasurer of the National Gideon Association, the group that distributed Bibles to hotels. His name was Bob Van Kampen, and he wanted to sound me out about becoming pastor of the church where he was a deacon, Western Springs Baptist Church, about 20 miles southeast of Wheaton. Since my work at the Tab had been an extracurricular part-time thing, I felt ready to consider a change. In January 1943, midway through my senior year, I began to feel the responsibility of supporting a wife. I was also attracted by the proximity of the University of Chicago with its strong anthropology department, offering advanced study opportunities. Hence, I accepted the call to Western Springs. I had already preached there as a student, and I could begin work there after college commencement. In my enthusiasm, however, I forgot to consult my bride-to-be. She let me know in no uncertain terms that she didn't appreciate such insensitivity. I could not blame her. Both Ruth and I felt sure the pastorate would be a temporary thing. For me, it was a possible stepping stone to qualifying for the Army chaplaincy. I made this priority clear to the church in Western Springs, and they accepted the condition. They even gave me the freedom to travel occasionally to evangelistic meetings. In June 1943, Ruth and I were graduated from Wheaton College in the same class. Although she was a junior when I entered as a second semester freshman, we ended up graduating in the same class. Ruth's parents had moved from Virginia to a house on the Presbyterian Conference grounds at Montreat, North Carolina, just east of Asheville. We were married there in August, on the night of Friday the 13th, with a full moon in the sky. As newlyweds in our first pastorate, Ruth and I were pretty typical lovebirds, I guess. We took hikes in the sunshine and in the rain, especially enjoying the arboretum nearby. On rare occasions, I went golfing and Ruth caddied for me. It was a major excursion to go into Chicago and to see movies at Telenews, an all-newswheel theater on North State Street. In spite of my rough edges, the church people couldn't have been nicer to us. Attendance began to grow steadily, getting into the 90s by October and passing 100 2 months later, about double the previous average. One day, while I was driving down a street, a man driving in the opposite direction pulled up next to me. "You are Billy Graham?" "Yes, sir." "I am Tory Johnson," he said by way of introduction. "Oh, yes," I responded enthusiastically. "I've heard you lots of times on the radio." He called on the phone a little later. "I've got too many things on my plate at this large growing church and my main radio program on Sunday afternoon," he said. "I have another radio program called Songs in the Night that I would like to give to you. I have prayed about it, thought about it, and I think you are the one who should have it." I said I would think and pray about it too, and I would have a talk with the deacons at my church. "Okay," he said, "call me when you've made a decision." So I took it to the deacons at the church. It would cost $150 a week for the radio time on WCFL in Chicago, heard in the Midwest and into the South and East. Little did I realize that this would be one of the turning points of my life. Ruth did not like the idea at first, Ministry at the Village Church. I had suggested the change of name from Western Springs Baptist Church because there were mainly Lutherans and Congregationalists, but very few Baptists in the surrounding area, already was demanding more than enough of my time and strength. Initially, the church board rejected the idea due to lack of money, but when the needs for financing and staffing were provided, God's answer seemed clear to go ahead. Bob Van Kampen agreed to provide the startup funding. I preached for the radio program for the first time in early December, and several weeks later, following our Sunday evening service, we started broadcasting live from our basement church in Western Springs. The first thing I wanted to do was to get a marquee name on the program. It was unlikely that listeners would have heard of our church or of me. But what about George Beverly Shea, the handsome bass baritone who at that time was a staff announcer at the Moody Bible Institute station WMBI? In my bold fashion, I went to the radio station office and brushed past his secretary. "Mr. Shea," I said, "my name is Billy Graham, and I'm pastor of the Village Church in Western Springs. Tori Johnson has asked us to take over his Sunday night radio show, and I'm convinced it will be most successful if you'd agree to appear on it." "Well, I don't know." I plunged on, outlining how I saw his singing fitting into the 45-minute program.